Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Mark Brody. Valley weather for the rest of today. Sunny skies expected, and we may reach a high temperature around 94. Skies will be clear tonight, should have dry conditions as well, with a low around 70. And then for tomorrow, sunny and breezy with a high of 95. Currently, relative humidity is at 8%, clear skies and 93 degrees.
First Lady Michelle Obama is expected to speak this hour in Phoenix at a rally for Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. This follows two other high-profile national Democrats visiting the state this week. Some observers are saying Arizona could vote Democratic in a presidential election for the first time since 1996. The Real Clear Politics average shows Clinton up by a little more than a point here over Republican Donald Trump. KJZZ's Will Stone is at the Phoenix Convention Center covering the First Lady's visit. And Will, can you describe the scene there for us?
Yeah, Mark, the convention center over the last couple hours, supporters, people who are excited to see First Lady Michelle Obama have been trickling in. And at this point, it's gone pretty packed. You might even be able to hear there are people kind of shouting and yelling, holding signs, AZ loves Hillary and FLOTUS. And I would say there are at least a couple thousand people here at this point. We don't have an exact number, but everyone is very excited to see the First Lady.
Well, you've had a chance to speak with some of the attendees. What kinds of things are they saying about the fact that First Lady Michelle Obama is here, the fact that the presidential race seems to be tightening here in Arizona?
They are excited. I would say many supporters ecstatic at the idea that Arizona really is in play this year. And recent polling does show Hillary Clinton with a narrow lead over Donald Trump. I've spoken with several folks here who say they feel like they've been waiting for this day for decades even. I spoke to one lady who's lived here 35 years, and she said she has never felt this level of excitement and really actually had seen this many Democrats in the same room around her. So you're hearing those kind of sentiments from people. Spoke to someone else who said she's always felt like the kind of a missionary, you know, a Democrat who's trying to convert people here in red Arizona. And now she is hopeful that this really could be an indicator that Arizona is changing and turning blue.
Michelle Obama is obviously the third Hillary Clinton surrogate to be in the state this week. Chelsea Clinton, Hillary Clinton's daughter, was at ASU yesterday. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders was in Flagstaff and Tucson on Tuesday. Do the folks with whom you spoke seem to think that that's an indication that Mrs. Clinton might actually pull this race out in Arizona?
They do. Several people have mentioned the other high-profile Democrats who've been here this week. They take that as a sign that the Clinton campaign is really investing in Arizona and sees it as quite a competitive state. I talked to one supporter here who's lived in Arizona for more than a decade, and she said that what she's hearing from her friends is she feels like a lot of women are actually going to come out to vote, and not necessarily because Hillary Clinton is a woman, she said, but because some of the unfavorable views they have towards Donald Trump and what some of the comments he's made about women, that she thinks this has really rallied voters who might otherwise not be as inclined to come out and cast their vote this year.
Have you gotten a sense from folks there as to what they hope to hear from Michelle Obama, or what folks are expecting that she might talk about?
The first reaction you get from people is that they're just excited she's here in Arizona at all, and that they will be close by seeing her give this speech just a couple weeks before the election. People are talking about they'd like to hear her say some things about, obviously, Hillary Clinton. She is a surrogate for Hillary here, and what Hillary's goals are for women, you know, in terms of women's rights issues, those types of things. And also following up on some of the issues raised in the debate last night, some of the accusations that Donald Trump made. I think they would like to hear some of that pushback from Michelle, but it's unclear whether we'll actually get into the details of that from the First Lady.
That's KJZZ's Will Stone at the Phoenix Convention Center, where First Lady Michelle Obama is speaking this afternoon. Will, thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
We're just 19 days from Election Day, and some Arizonans have already mailed in their early ballots. And the results of a new Morrison Institute Arizona Republic poll show November 8th may be a difficult one for Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump and Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. The poll was conducted statewide among registered voters between October the 10th and October 15th. Tom Riley, Morrison Institute director, is with me to talk about the results. Tom, your poll shows Hillary Clinton ahead of Donald Trump in Arizona by 5.1%. In the Senate race, John McCain leads Ann Kirkpatrick by 11%. How much of that has to do with a lack of statewide name recognition for Kirkpatrick?
Yeah, she still had a large amount of individuals that did not know her. The interesting aspect of that polling question is that we were able to track his favorability ratings in our August poll when he was supportive of Trump, or at least endorsing him. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the October poll, which occurred after the second debate, also captured the time period that he said he was not supporting him. His favorability and unfavorability remained pretty much the same. If anything, his favorability increased slightly and his unfavorability decreased slightly.
Someone else who has been in office for a very long time is Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. The numbers in this one, especially interesting. You found that Paul Penzone, they're very favorable toward him and much less favorable toward the sheriff.
What was not surprising is the large percent of unfavorable among Latino voters, mm-hmm. which had remained consistent from August to October. What was surprising is the large number of white voters that had an unfavorable rating, and that very well could be driving the numbers in that race.
Trump, McCain, and Arpaio, these are all sort of larger-than-life figures in their own way. And there's been a tradition, maybe less so in Arizona, but a tradition of saying, all right, let me follow what the letter is after the candidate. So either I vote for all R's, I vote for all D's. Interesting to look at these numbers that Trump is in the 30s, McCain is over 50, Arpaio is, so people are really looking at these three individually.
And this is, you know, I mean, I think the big question about this race is that are we seeing a shifting of the electorate in Arizona, or is it just uniqueness about the candidates in this race? But yeah, I mean, you see this, you know, very high level of support for McCain. Those same voters have different opinions about candidates in the same party. So a lot of people are speculating what this means, and we still may not know what it means after the election because this is anything but a traditional campaign on many respects. There's a lot of uniqueness with candidates, and that may be playing in high on people's minds.
And a couple of ballot measures you also looked at, Props 205 and 206. 205 would be related to recreational marijuana, and 206 is the minimum wage.
So 205 was interesting is that there was really no change at all on those favoring the proposition, the marijuana proposition, in August versus October. And in August, when we polled, there really was very little of the campaigns on either side taking place. We've seen that ramp up considerably in October. So the numbers show just barely over 50% of individuals supporting. The undecideds, if anything, are tracking a little towards against. So the against number has risen a few percentage points. But for the most part, people seem to have made up their minds. I'm not sure if the campaigns are having much of an impact. The minimum wage, there has been, again, very little movement. It was about 61% in August. It's 58.4% in the October poll. The numbers against haven't moved. It's about 31% in August, 32% here.
Tom Riley, the man at the head of the Morrison Institute. We've been talking about their latest poll about president, Senate, sheriff, and propositions. And Tom, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
With early voting underway in Arizona, you may be seeing more mailers in your mailbox and be getting more knocks on your door from candidates and their campaigns. And that's not by accident. Technology is helping campaigns talk to voters more efficiently than in the past. And KJZZ's Jude Joffe-Block has seen some of that firsthand. So, Jude, what's going on out there on the trail?
Well, last month I went up to Prescott and I followed two Democratic volunteers as they were going door to door talking to voters there. But they weren't actually going door to door. There were certain households they were visiting, others they were skipping. So, for example, if a house was a solid Republican voter, they didn't need to waste their time there. So to find out which houses they should visit, they pulled out a smartphone. And on this app they had, they got a route of which houses to visit. Let's take a listen.
And this app, is this a new app?
Yeah, it's called Minivan, and it's basically what we use. It's a paperless way to do this, which actually helps us out a lot. The next one would be 1127.
And that was volunteer John Duncan you heard from first. He was training a brand new volunteer that day, Nathaniel Hochschild, a senior in high school. And the app tells them the voter's name and the vote history at a given house. And after they talked to a voter and found out how they were thinking about the presidential and Senate races, the volunteers were able to enter that data right back into the app on the spot.
With her, I put committed to vote yes. Support Anchor Patrick, I put strongly, but with Hillary leaning.
Perfect.
So, Jude, these are Democratic volunteers that you were with. How is the Democratic Party in Arizona more broadly trying to use this new technology?
Right. Well, I'm told that the Democratic Party is using this all over the state in their different field offices. Now that time has passed since I was out reporting, now the emphasis is on early voting. And so volunteers who are going out and walking neighborhoods now will be able to use this app, Minivan, to be able to find out, for example, if a voter is on the early voting list, remind them to mail it back or tell them about the early voting in-person locations near them, or the fact that, for example, this Saturday there's going to be early voting locations open and, you know, the parties are going to let their folks know about that.
Is the state Republican Party using anything similar to this?
They are. They have their version. It's an app called i360. And I think I heard from one of their GOP staffers, Sergio Arellano, a couple weeks ago that they have a few that they're using. I saw them using i360 in the field in Nogales. But he did mention that, you know, and it did give them the walk list in the same way. I think because of Nogales, perhaps quirks in the data system, he mentioned they weren't able to load all the data into the phone. So they were using a combination of paper and the phone app that day. You know, what's also interesting, he mentioned, you know, look, not all of our volunteers have smartphones. And I did hear as well that another challenge is that these apps, while very efficient and helpful, they do drain your battery. So it makes it hard to have the volunteers out there for hours and hours on end.
Drain batteries, clearly a bipartisan issue. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Thanks, Jude.
Thank you.
And Jude mentioned the Democratic volunteers using a program called Minivan. It's made by a company called NGP Van, which calls itself the leading technology provider to Democrats and progressive organizations and works with campaigns up and down ballot. John Lee is the firm's chief technology officer, and he joins me. So, John, what's the advantage to campaigns of using this kind of tool as opposed to just doing things the old-fashioned way?
It's a much more precise way to target voters, I think. You know, at the end of the day, campaigns care about being efficient, right? There's a deadline. You're not going to move election day. And the question is, you know, given your volunteers, given the money you have, how best to use them, you know, how you deploy your resources and which voters you talk to, all of that is important in gaining that efficiency and eking out that efficiency. And using our tools allows you to do that, both from a top-level strategic perspective about, you know, who to talk to, but then also then the actual workflow of how do I talk to these voters if I'm out there.
How do you gauge whether or not campaigns are actually being more effective and using these tools properly and whether or not these are actually helping?
Yeah, so I mean, it's obviously not our job to sort of police how these tools are used. We believe that the tools that we're providing, you know, naturally will help folks gain efficiency. So I think some of those efficiencies are, you know, are no-brainers, right? You've got a volunteer at the door, and if they're using their mobile phone to see information about the voter, to talk to the voter, and then collecting the responses right there, then it saves time on data entry and other things. The same logic applies to phone banking and the other modes of voter contact. At a strategic level, you know, one of the bigger efficiencies that we help drive is sort of coordination over time across all of the different campaigns that are on the Democratic side of the ticket. We work with the Democratic National Committee, and their voter data is what sort of is at the basis of the tools that we provide to these individual campaigns.
When you're developing these programs, how do you balance what I would imagine to be your desire to be as data intensive and precise as possible, with the knowledge that in many cases these are going to be used by campaign volunteers who maybe have varying degrees of tech savviness.
Our approach is that this data isn't going to get collected unless you make the tools easy to use and make the tools, you know, worth using. I think one of the mistakes that a lot of campaigns or other, you know, software, sort of the whiz-bang approach to how to make an impact in elections is, you know, focusing too much on sort of the magic of big data. And, you know, I think we focus on workflow tools ultimately at the end of the day.
This election season, the concept of data hacks and data breaches has become a real big campaign issue. What kinds of steps do you try to take to make sure that your data is not part of those types of hacks and breaches?
Obviously, I can't get into specifics, but we've spent, you know, lots of time and money making sure that we are as secure as we possibly can be this cycle.
And are you fairly confident that you are?
Yes.
John Lee is Chief Technology Officer for the firm NGP Van, which provides technology to Democrats and progressive organizations across the country. In the introduction of her new book, Bearing Witness, 36 Mormon Women Talk Candidly About Love, Sex, and Marriage, editor Holly Welker writes, "It's hard to be Mormon and not think a lot about marriage. That's because marriage is so central to Mormon culture and theology, but she says it's not often talked about in personal ways." So in this new book, she gathered the essays of 36 Mormon women who write firsthand about their marriages, and the show's Lauren Gilger spoke with her recently, and she joins me. So Lauren, why did Welker want to tackle this topic?
Well, she was raised Mormon. Welker is a third-generation Arizonan who grew up in Thatcher, a town she says is so Mormon that they held their high school prom in the church's cultural hall. But she stopped attending church in her 20s. And when I talked to her, she said she started thinking about this book when her mother died.
One of the things I began to realize was that there were things about her life I didn't understand, and there were questions I never asked her. Mm-hmm. And in lieu of asking her, since I couldn't, I started asking friends about their marriages. And I just started wondering more about what marriage felt like for people in it, especially since I myself am still single. I've never married. And when I went looking for stories about Mormon marriage, I realized that there actually weren't that many. And I thought, hey, actually, I can put this book together.
So what did you start to hear from women?
Well, initially, one problem was getting the women to actually talk about their marriages. They would immediately begin to talk about motherhood, which is not all that surprising given that marriage and motherhood are often linked in Mormonism. But I had to be very specific about my requests in terms of the story I wanted them to tell in order to get the story I really wanted.
So you obviously haven't attended church, you said, in a very long time.
Yes.
And are not really participating in the faith anymore. But some of the women that wrote in the book,
yes,
definitely are.
Yes.
And they have, it sounds like, a really broad range of experiences in their marriage. Can you kind of encapsulate that for us?
I wanted a range. That was part of the whole point. That was showing that there is not a single monolithic LDS experience for marriage was part of the point. There are two essays in the collection by women who are in same-sex relationships. There are essays by women who never married. There are essays about divorce. There is one essay about widowhood. There are essays about women who lost their faith and what that did to their marriage. One of the essays is by a woman who got married at 19 and just got lucky. You know, literature relies on conflict. And so most of the essays are about marriages with difficulties. And I really wanted an essay by someone whose marriage had been pretty consistently happy. And the woman who provided that got married at 19 and feels like she just feels lucky. She just managed to marry the right guy.
So what kind of reactions did you get from some of these women, especially some who maybe aren't professional writers, when you asked them to contribute to this?
Some told me no. Some started writing and got to a point where a few actually got to a point where they said, I can't keep working on this. It makes me question my marriage. This is too uncomfortable. Some women were extremely enthusiastic and felt like their story would help others. There were a number of women who had a story they really wanted to tell but did not want to sign their names. There are quite a few pseudonyms in the book. And people were occasionally suspicious. You know, what are you going to do with this? Is the book going to be pro or anti-Mormon? That's a question I get even now that it's in print.
So is the book pro or anti-Mormon?
No, it's not. It's a peer-reviewed book. It's not a polemic. I do not take a stance either attacking or defending the LDS Church. My main point is to provide a platform and a framework for individual women to tell what they perceive as the truth about their marriage. And I would hope people could understand why that is neither pro nor anti-Mormon. It's simply, it's 36 women, 36 English-speaking women telling their stories.
All right. Well, Holly Welker is the editor of the new book, Bearing Witness. And Holly, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's just a pleasure to talk about this project. I had such a great time.
And that was the show's Lauren Gilger.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Andy. I've been shining shoes for 48 years, and you know you're looking fine if your shoes are shined. I started in 1967, so I shined shoes as a kid. Shoe shines was a quarter. This is a color spray. I shined Muhammad Ali's shoes in Kansas City. Funny story, he got down and he gave me a $20 bill and told me to keep this change.
So please leave your name, number, and a brief message after the tone, and I'll get back to you.
It's kind of like a doctor analyzing a patient. I look at the shoe and I analyze from the time I look at it just what kind of work I got to put into it and what I got to do. And there we go. You have one shine shoe.
I will be back. I got other ones I need done.
All righty. I appreciate your business.
Thank you.
You take care.
That's Andy Millsap, Shining Shoes. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org. Arizonans looking to buy health insurance on the federal exchange this year will find their options limited. In every county except one, there is only one insurer in the marketplace, and rates are going up significantly this year. Many consumers, especially in Maricopa County, will have to sign up for new plans when open enrollment begins next month. KJZZ's Will Stone has been reporting on the Affordable Care Act in Arizona and joins me. Will, clearly not many options this year. What are people going to find when they look for new plans?
As you mentioned, Steve, for virtually the entire state, consumers will have no options in terms of insurers because, as you mentioned, every county in the state except for Pima, there's only one carrier. So in Maricopa County, that insurer is Health Net, which was recently acquired by a St. Louis company called Centene. And for the rest of the state, Blue Cross and Blue Shield will be the insurer offering four plans too. But, you know, this is a pretty dramatic decrease from previous years. Last year in Maricopa, there were eight insurers on the exchange. The year before that, 12. So clearly insurers are not feeling very confident about entering the marketplace for next year.
Now, people are always concerned about rates. Will the prices be going up?
Yes. Just this week, the Arizona Department of Insurance released the finalized rates and the policies that it has approved for 2017. And not surprisingly, the rates are climbing rather significantly. In Maricopa, Health Net's rates are increasing on average about 75%. So, for example, a 40-year-old non-tobacco user would be paying monthly premiums of anywhere from $445 to about $660. Also, for Blue Cross Blue Shield, which covers the rest of the state, as I mentioned, those rates are going up about 51%.
Well, you mentioned what one of the big challenges is for consumers that aren't a lot of options out there. What are the other big challenges?
Finding new doctors and hospitals, potentially. More than 120,000 people in Maricopa County alone will be getting their policies canceled. this year, and they will need to pick a new plan. And most likely that what was in network on their old plan may not be, say, in the health net policy in that network. And these are HMO plans with very limited benefits out of network. So this is really where people may find themselves frustrated or concerned. I spoke about this with Bill Gould, who runs the insurance agency Black Gould & Associates here in Phoenix. And he says about 4,000 of their customers, policyholders, are having their plans canceled this year, and they'll need to find new ones.
This means you have to start all over with a new provider. This creates a tremendous amount of emotional anxiety with people that have built up trust and faith in the physician they're seeing. These people played by the rules. They went to the doctors in the network, and now the network's going away.
And I have talked to consumers around the Valley who are having this experience, needing to switch policies maybe several times over the last couple of years. And some people live in areas where suddenly there may not be a hospital or doctor that's in network nearby.
So, Will, what are those running the exchange saying about Arizona's situation this year? It sounds pretty dire.
They're pushing back against criticism that these climbing premiums and this lack of competition in the marketplace represents the failure of Obamacare. Remember, the state of Arizona only approves the rates to make sure they're justifiable. This is a federal marketplace, after all. But there are some key points here. And the first is that there are multiple plans, even though there may only be one insurer. And the second is that the subsidies, about 75% of Arizonans will qualify for these subsidies. And according to the federal government, they believe that most people who qualify for the subsidies will be able to buy plans at about $75 or less a month. Kevin Griffith is with the Department of Health and Human Services, and he says that's why the rate increases don't tell the full story.
The vast majority of folks who are on the marketplace receive tax credits, and a large percentage also receive cost-sharing reductions. The sort of headline numbers that you see in the newspapers, that's not what people pay.
And it's important to note that those tax credits increase as the rates increase. So Griffith says actually more people who've been off exchange may now actually be able to go on the exchange because the rates are going up. I mean, interestingly, Arizona had the lowest rates in the entire healthcare.gov system until just last year. So the thought is the rates are finally catching up. This is a transition year, and we'll see things kind of continue to even out in the coming years.
KJZZ's Will Stone with the latest on the Affordable Care Act in Arizona. Will, thanks as always.
Thanks, Steve.
Many of us make connections with animals, but usually there are pets like dogs, cats, even rabbits. Deborah Copenhaver Fellows grew up on a ranch and became close to horses at a very young age, learning how to ride them not long after she started walking. When she started sculpting more than four decades ago, that passion for horses became a vital part at the core of her art. And she joins me. Deborah, where does the connection between humans and horses come from? Is there a clear feeling?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting you'd ask this, because I've had some experiences in my lifetime where I can say positively there is the case of that. One of the first sculptures that I ever did was of an old mare and a woman with two little children walking in the snow. And the name of the piece was called The Way of Mothers. That came from us living way up high on the mountain, and my mother would drive in at night with the groceries, and we couldn't get in because of the snow. And we'd walk up the mountain, and the two of us, my brother and I, would walk in her footsteps because the snow was so deep. But at different times when I started to school, again, the school bus could only make it so close to the house on the mountain, and they would put me on a horse, and I would ride down to, about 2 miles to where I could get on the bus, put the reins back on the horse, and then cluck to her, and she would go back to the house so they'd know I made it to the school bus. The horse was always diligent and always consistently would go back. I can see it with these older horses when the babies are around. They seem to sense it. They seem to know.
So even when you were a young woman and branching out and going and learning more about your art, did you always expect horses to be an important part of your life?
It's just a love. It's a love of the animal. It just was in me as a little girl, and I knew that I'd always be involved with them or have the love of them. You know, there's something about seeing a horse perform in some of the events that you see today, jumping. Horses that jump, I jumped for a little while, did three-day eventing. I never get over the fact that tears come to my eyes when I see an animal perform for an individual so wholeheartedly without holding back. It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. And I think that kind of impact on your senses is entrenched. I don't think that you ever leave those special moments in your mind and your memory.
I think there's an obvious warmth that comes both from the spiritual sense, but also the physical sense of dealing with a living animal and an animal that you're close to. And sculpture is different, though, because sculpture, you're able to show people the beauty, but there is not, because it's obviously not, a sculpture is not alive in the same sense. How do you bring the love you have from horses, the living horses, into the work you've done as an artist?
That's the magic of being an equine artist, being able to give that experience, to translate that feeling to someone that looks at the bronze. I mean, to me, that's the most success that I could achieve as an artist, is to share that experience that I've had. Let me give you an example. I did a sculpture once called She Flies Without Wings, and it's a woman on horseback running, just free running, and she's holding onto the mane with one hand and holding her hand back. You know when you stick your hand out the window of a car and you let your hand kind of just float on the wind going by? That's kind of what this sculpture does. It's just it captures the movement. And I had a little niece here last year, and I took her out. We live on the Empire Ranch, a beautiful facility in front of our home. And I had her on a really nice horse, and she said, "Aunt Debbie, I feel like I'm flying without wings." And I said, "Well, that's the sculpture I did." So she expressed exactly that feeling that I was trying to express in the bronze.
Is there a similar feeling when you're sculpting? What does that feel like when you're creating and you're feeling that move through you and your hands and everything's going well?
I had someone just talk to me the other day, someone that I admire highly. His name is Harley Brown, and he's an international portrait artist. He was talking to me in the studio, and he says, you know, there is a time when you start getting into your art that you're almost in a subconscious level of what you're doing. You're not thinking, it's happening. You've got this vision, and you just, when you hit that zone, usually you're at the peak of your creativity. After you've done it for 40 years, you start to understand you don't know anything, and you just have to let go to have it happen.
How much riding do you do now? Do you feel like, could you go a day without riding a horse, or is that such a part of your life that, and where you guys live, that you have to?
You know, I have to say, riding isn't always what's important. To me, is just the involvement on a day-to-day basis. I like to hear him eat. I like to feed him. I like to have him nicker in the morning when my husband and I go out. Or there's two of them are by the bedroom window in the morning when we wake up, almost waking us up at night. We have a burro that at 5 o'clock you can hear him clear down at the barn. He's like a rooster in the morning at most farms. If the horses are out, they're at the studio at 5 o'clock because that's the magic hour for dinner. So there's every part of it I like. I love the feeling of being on horseback, and I would hope to do that for as long as I can live. My dad's 92 and he's still on horseback, so that's the plan.
Sculptor Deborah Copenhaver Fellows, who specializes in horses, she's featured in the October issue of Arizona Highways.
Steve, did you ever make a tin can phone as a kid, you know, with the two cans and the string?
Hello.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet, but there's a guy in Phoenix who takes tin cans a little further. You know, things like robots, sharks, robot sharks.
But before they become robot sharks, they're just cans filled with beans or corn or fruit cocktail. The show's Annika Klein tells us this local artist found his calling with a can-do attitude.
Robot sale. Buy a robot. Get into heaven.
Meet Alexi DeVilliers.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you today?
He's at a First Friday art walk in Phoenix, chatting with passersby. About 40 of his handmade sculptures sit on a shelf.
I make toilet paper holders, airplanes that are fans, sharks, dogs, lamps, trucks. Yeah.
And robots. Lots and lots of robots. With bottle cap eyes, forks for hands, and rotund middles, like another robot you might know.
I have two robots that are in my backyard.
Stacy Wolosik is a repeat customer.
One is like the bigger bucket style robot. It's all blue. And then I have one that is like a chicken.
And sometime between purchasing the blue robot and the chicken, she learned the story behind them.
Buy a robot, get into heaven. I feed elderly homeless every Saturday, and these are all the cans that are left over. There's the ticket, right?
What made me feel better about buying it, that it wasn't just a mass-produced item. It was actually somebody who's using the money for something good.
Wolosik takes home her third sculpture, a chubby yellow bot.
He is two tuna cans and most likely a tomato sauce can.
And all those cans start here, in DeVilliers' tiny kitchen. Every Saturday, he prepares meals for homeless seniors.
Now that's a Mexican casserole. Look at that.
He sets up the casserole, green beans, and cookies, assembly line style, and piles the food into 110 styrofoam boxes. It started with bringing meals to some people hanging out in a nearby park. Then DeVilliers says he and his wife made more meals and found more people to pass them out to.
And then the next week we did the same thing, and then the same thing. And then we would go all the way downtown when we discovered that 13th Avenue in Jefferson. That's
near a large shelter and lots of other services for those who are homeless.
And then we had about 20 meals left, and we were coming down Jefferson, and we saw these old people just standing out in front of a door. So they were real happy to take our last 20 meals. Someone opened the door and says, hey, there's food out here. There were 80 more elderly homeless inside.
They had found Justice Center, a resource center for seniors. Since then, this has been Alexi's Saturday routine for the past 6 years. Cook the food, pack it up, and take it downtown.
Hello, all. At that shelter, it's only for elderly, so I thought, let's just go help them. I mean, who's going to hire somebody 63, 65, 67? He's barely living on a Social Security, can't afford food.
They have nowhere to go. They're homeless. They're hungry.
Diane Nevels is part of the weekend crew, and she says this shelter is the only place in the area that serves seniors on the weekends.
The senior count is really high down here. Each year, the count increases.
Come try one of my home cookings.
DeVilliers always takes the cans from cooking and turns them into sculptures, but it used to be a side gig. Then the economy and the housing collapse cost him his maintenance jobs. He and his wife became pregnant, and she quit her job to care for their son.
So I devoted full time to just making art, making art, making art.
And the cooking became more of a need.
Because if I don't feed the homeless, I don't have the cans to make the material, to make the robots, to sell, to pay for my electricity and my gas, to cook the food.
This created a circle that feeds itself. And DeVilliers doesn't mind. He says serving the shelter is important to him. Plus, making art at home means more time with his family. That's why every Saturday he cooks, and every first Friday.
Robot sale. Buy a robot. Get into heaven.
For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.